Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 653.
Let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. Well, before we go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard, I will say next Sunday, which would be the 29th of March, is the season finale of Walking and Talking Dead. Walking Dead will be 90 minutes. Sounds like some shit's going to go down, but I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know. But our guests are going to be Scott Gimple, Norman Reedus, Melissa McBride, who plays Carol, and a surprise cast member, which doesn't always mean anything. We tried to break that pattern, so it doesn't always mean anything. But it is a finale, so I'm guessing shit's going to go down. But who knows? And obviously, At Midnight's on all this week. And now let's get to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. The Family Dinner is a comedy troupe in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. They do live shows, movie interruptions, and many, many other things. So go to facebook.com/Family Dinner Improv to find out. Also, Dave would like to plug his podcast, Superhero Speak. They talk about comic books and other comic-related news. You can find it at superheroespeak.com. And the group that shall not be named, Inc., the world's largest Harry Potter fan club, is hosting MystiCon this May 21st to the 25th in Laconia, New Hampshire. I probably said that wrong, so please don't tweet him and go, it's pronounced Laconia. MystiCon is a fully immersive Harry Potter convention with over 100 hours of formal programming, special events, performances, all taking place in private resort that is 100% taken over by the convention. No muggles to be found, unless you're cosplaying as a muggle. Go to MISTI-CON.org for more info. This episode of this podcast is our old friend Joe Lynch, who is a guy that I knew from G4. Really nice guy, director. He's promoting the film Everly, which is available now on demand and pre-order for Blu-ray. But it's fun when people that you... Well, I didn't really start at G4. Let's say I started my new life at G4. So, in a sense, Joe and I kind of started together. And, of course, he knows Matt and Jonah as well for a long time. So, we're very pleased that he has gone out and done good. Joe Lynch has done good. So, watch Everly when you can. Joe's an incredibly talented guy. And now, the Nerdist Podcast number 653 with our pal Joe Lynch.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I didn't know you worked in porn.
What? Everyone has to.
You were an editor? You were a porn editor?
When I first came out here, there was no work at all. You know, so.
Which was what year?
2003, okay. I guess. So I had come out here. Oh, is this the part where I say, are we recording now?
This is the part.
Sorry.
Someone's heard the podcast.
To go off on, but to go off on a tangent, maybe I'm just trying to divert from the porn job because my mom is listening. Oh, she knew all about it. She
must
did
have
my
known.
Taxes.
She must have known.
But. To side note, you guys got me through a lot of shit.
Really?
Big time. When I was in Serbia shooting Everly, this was the summer of 2013. It's Serbia. Not my town. And, you know, like, I packed up my iPhone with every... I listened to podcasts incessantly. Everything. I from Marin to, you know, might have heard him, to you guys, to everything on KCRW. I mean, it's what inspired our own podcast. I was just like, I love listening to these great conversations. And the fact that you guys have such a kind of relaxed, familial, family sort of situation, it just felt like I was hanging out with a bunch of buddies. So that was the summer that you guys had, let's see, Hader and Joss, and I think Feige was in there. It was a whole bunch of people that, you know, I'm fans of, but it was more the episodes where you guys were just kind of hanging out. It made me feel like I was at home. Like it got me over the homesickness. Seriously.
Except
I'm not
the one
just,
we did all in Serbian, which probably just reminded you exactly.
Then I just started running in circles, going, "Jesus Christ, help me!"
And then when we reenacted and did an audio version of a Serbian film, that was
right. It was really strange.
You will no. Okay, all right. I'm amongst friends here. Half of my crew worked on a Serbian film.
Oh shit!
And the stories that I could tell are not safe for Nerdist at all. But I will tell
one. As a
fan. We're all familiar with the cinematic classic that is a Serbian film.
Yes.
Did you actually watched it?
I've heard of
parts.
It. Because,
okay,
yeah,
all right.
Parts.
All right.
It's like everyone saw the one clip of the guy getting his head bashed in.
But you didn't see the newborn porn part.
No. The what?
Don't ask. Just Google it. I'm sure you'll find out. But
okay.
Katie, Google it.
If you're familiar
Katie,
with...
Don't.
No, Katie. Do not do that. But a lot of the crew... Everybody out in Serbia, they love making movies. You know, there's obviously not a lot of films go out there, but you know, they had November Man and 3 Days to Kill. So Hollywood is slowly realizing that there's a good marketplace.
The Hostel was out there too, right?
Great marketplace.
In
for
theory,
Nicolas
yes.
Cage
in production,
movies.
No. There was
where
no.
were they?
That was Bulgaria,
two?
I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you know, you'd meet all these great people, and I had mentioned like, oh, Serbian film, and they look at me like, you have seen Serbian film, and I'm like. I've seen many Serbian films, but I've definitely seen a Serbian film. And they looked at me like, are you okay? Like, did you survive? They made it seem like this was like a rite of passage, you know, like if you've been to war, you get the 1,000-yard stare after
right.
you've seen a Serbian film. Because the thing about that movie is that it's so beautifully shot. It's elegant. But a lot of the crew worked on it and they would just like look at me like, oh, that was a crazy movie. But, one of the makeup effects guys, we had to construct these characters in Everly that are, I'm just going to keep using references left and right, but there's these four guys that were inspired by the elements in Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, the best.
I can go on and on.
The lightning guy was my favorite.
Because he had those cool special effects
and
that still look good today.
They really do.
You know, those lightning effects on Blu-ray, most visual effects that are like optical effects just don't look good. But then you would have those moments where he'd steal Kim Cattrall, they'd slide up, and then the lightning would have a little Chinese character right before it goes.
Oh, yeah.
And for years I'd be like, what does that mean? And then I looked up and I'm like, it means nothing. It's just it's something that Richard Edlund, the guy who did the visual effects, was just like, that cool. That looks cool. But for years, I'd be like, that's such a great effect.
So it's basically just basically the equivalent of a drunk girl's tattoo.
It's a tramp stamp of the visual effects. but we had, you know, so I had to go meet with this visual effects guy who was deaf. So try having a conversation with a deaf gentleman about these practical effects, and he would just nod his head. Yeah, yes, mm-hmm. yes. I'd be like, sorry, so I'm looking for a kind of Big Trouble in Little... It turned into that moment when Jeff Bridges was like, you know, explaining porn to somebody.
Right.
You know, I'm looking for something funny, like Ordinary People's, you know. And I'd be like, it's kind of Big Trouble in Little China. He meets a little, you know, professionally, and he'd be like, uh-huh. And I'm like, I don't think he's getting any of this.
Yeah.
But then he, you know, then he started sketching it out, and it was perfect. I'm like, oh, okay. So then he's like, oh, so you like a Serbian film, right? I'm like, I don't know if one can constitute saying like a Serbian film. Did I endure it? Yes. Did I, you know, I guess respect the visuals? Yes. Can't say much more about that. But he's like, let me show you something. So he goes over to his wide array of spare parts, body parts or whatever. Latex body parts,
sure,
silicone
sure.
body parts. And he pulls out this like wrapped up. I'll be there in a second. he pulls out this like wrapped up bubble taped thing and he hands it to me. And I'm like, oh, and I start to slowly unravel it. It was the baby from the.
Oh, no way.
Aww. Yeah. I can say I didn't take a couple selfies with it. You know.
Yeah, of course.
There was a makeshift selfie stick that I popped it on and started, you know, doing some puppetry. But it was.
Katie,
seriously,
what is that hammering?
Must be upstairs.
It's all those fans.
Because there's nothing beyond this wall, right?
It's upstairs.
It's upstairs.
No, Kyle just went upstairs.
Chris,
no.
Chris, you gonna go throw your dick around? You gonna go throw that dick around, Chris?
Stop hammering!
Yes.
Then no, you're gonna
and
throw
the Hardwick
pussy
has
around.
Spoken. That was amazing, sir.
It stopped.
It worked. Somebody just went, oh.
Yeah, but it was
shit,
like
I'm
probably right at the moment where Kyle was like, "It would be very nice if you could stop hammering just for
you
a moment."
That,
stop hammering!
That was the moment where
Kyle's head is at the door with a hammer.
You know, Chris, you just peeked around at the moment and was like, and then stop hammering.
Kyle just sheepishly gives the thumb up.
Sorry about that, Kyle.
You should listen to him.
Were you mid asking them nicely?
Cool. Have you ever been to Serbia?
I've not been to Serbia.
It's beautiful. Like Belgrade is where we shot the movie, and again, like. Part of the concept of Everly was that you could shoot it anywhere. It's a film that takes place all in one location. So when I would go into pitch meetings, I'd be like, hey, you can shoot it in Timbuktu. It doesn't matter where you shoot it. You know, like, it's cost effective. We can do it anywhere we want. Didn't know that they were actually going to say, what about Timbuktu? You know, I just thought like, hey, you know, we could probably get a place down in Venice or go up to, you know, Northridge and just shoot it in a warehouse. No, they... You know, they wanted
North
to give
Ridge,
me...
the Serbia of Southern California.
Yes, pretty much. Oh, boy, the newborn porn market there is fantastic.
Yeah.
But, you know, they wanted to give me as many days as possible to get as much as I could. And this was a, you know, low-budget film. And they gave me two options. They said, you know, I think it was Singapore or Serbia. So, I looked up both, and I'm like, Serbia seems nice. But it was also like, well, you can get 28 days in Singapore, or you can get 30 days in Serbia. I'm like, okay, those two extra days I know I'm going to be kicking myself later for not having, so
right.
I might as well go with Serbia. So when I get there, first thing I see is there's these women who are outside, and they have babies attached to their breasts as they're breastfeeding, and they're holding out their hands for money. And one of the babies actually kind of went and like put their hand out. I'm like, that is good. Like that is a slick touch. I've seen people, you know, use kids before or dogs, like, please feed my dog, you know, but they're using actual babies and breast milk, you know.
Wow.
Unfortunately, my dollar was not good enough for them. They were just like, American dollar.
They didn't even want that.
Be gone. But then we would drive through the city, and there's two parts of Belgrade. There's Old Belgrade and New Belgrade. Old Belgrade is really this just beautiful old part of town with old buildings, old architecture. It also has all of the remnants of all the bombings that we did back in the late 90s. So every time that we would drive past, a cab driver, without fail, every time, they'd go, see that? That was you.
Oh, shit.
Without fail. I was like, on a day off, I'm going to see Elysium, and I was just like, I need to just clear my brain. I'm going to go see some fucking sci-fi. It'd be great. And we passed about four buildings. And by the fourth building, I go, oh, I know. It was my fault. I got it. Sorry.
Shit.
And then we go into a conversation about Neil Blomkamp. Like, really? Like, he actually drove around a little bit longer. He's like, oh, so what are you seeing? I'm like, oh, I'm going to go see Elysium. Oh, you mean the District 9 guy? I'm like,
oh, wow.
Wow.
He must be excited about Chappie.
He sure is, Chris.
We'll see. You know, I don't know. But the weird thing about Serbian theaters is, are we already on a Chappie tip now?
I'm sorry. I don't know what it is. I guess I wasn't here for your Chappie jokes.
What?
No.
What the joke is or what the movie is?
I know what the movie is. I've seen the billboards and the trailer. I don't know
if you really know the movie if you've seen the billboards.
Yeah, it's Short Circuit.
Short Circuit fucked RoboCop in South Africa.
Yeah.
That's basically
what it
is.
I think we're looking more Short Circuit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, missing Michael McKean, of course.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah.
But just to have a conversation with this person never met before in my life about movies, you know, and that's what this is all about. That's why I got into this, was I grew up obsessed with movies. Like, my first movie was... Sorry, Mom. I'm gonna talk about this again. But my first movie was Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah,
she's gonna be fine.
I was two. She couldn't find a babysitter. No joke. She was a big horror movie fan when she was a kid. So, you know, she was like, of course, naturally, you would bring your 2 year old to a movie that has the disclaimer, warning: this film is too intense for pretty much everybody due to extreme violence. You know, and of course, my mom's like, two, please. And I remember going, I remember being in the theater. You know, so those moments that you remember when, you know, Star Wars came out, or, you know, seeing Jaws for the first
time.
Chappie. Or Chappie for the first time, of course, you know, like, wow, robots. But I remember watching that movie, and I don't know if you guys recall the film at all, the Romero version. But there's
quite
a moment
vividly.
In the beginning of the film.
Pretty much every frame.
I was baiting Jonah right now. I'm like, all right, bring it on, brother.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I know you can talk Day of the Dead.
With Sarah
Pauly?
So it's Sarah Pauly and Ty Burrell.
And Tom Savini.
Yeah.
And there's this moment in the beginning of the film where this one zombie bites another zombie on the arm, right? And if you look very closely, in the movie itself projected on film, and then later on in the Laserdisc, you could see where Savini and his team went, we're good, and where the makeup stopped. You just see it. Like, it's a quick moment. It's probably 18 frames, but you see zombie, not zombie.
Yeah.
And I remember as a kid going, bullshit.
Nah.
Like, sorry, the mystique is gone. But it was like from that and then Raiders of the Lost Ark, back in our days, because I know I can say that to pretty much everybody here. Remember when they used to have the production books when you used to go to the theater? You know, they would have like Raiders of the Lost Ark, the complete artistic guide or whatever, the complete production guide. And they would just, you'd open it up and immediately you'd go, oh, so the ball was made of styrofoam and, you know, Alfred Molina's not an asshole. And, you know, and
how British.
He's British, of course. And, you know, and that's how you make the face melt and everything. But seeing all those elements and going like, oh, wow, this is movie magic. And I need to wear a baseball cap, dark sunglasses, and have a beard. So immediately, upon maybe five or six, I started shaving, and that's where I am today. But it was those dialogues that I had, you know, with people who couldn't even believe that I was watching these types of movies back then. It made me realize that you can start a conversation with anybody. You know, you go to a Starbucks or you go to Comic-Con or anywhere and just be like, hey, do you know Battle Royale? And you can litmus test whether or not, A, they've seen it, and B, if they, you know, they go, oh, yeah, that movie's great. Or C, they go, oh, Hunger Games. Right. You know, and then you go, okay, this conversation's over. Yeah. You know? But I slowly started to realize that having cinema in my life was just such an easy way to kind of break out of feeling awkward in school or, you know, just feeling antisocial, so to speak. It was that one thing that I knew, kind of like music as well, you know, maybe to a lesser extent, you know, we started bonding over Fart Barf, you know, the band Fart Barf.
Great band, Fart Barf.
Oh, you haven't heard Fart Barf?
No.
You'd like them.
Three guys in jumpsuits and simian massive jumpsuits.
Yeah.
Simian masks play kind of 80s Carpenter-esque like synth pop.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Live, amazing. They did a music video recently that was kind of like a horror parody.
Yeah.
That was great. But it was, I remember seeing something about Fart Barf on Twitter, and then Jonah and I, we all have this weird kind of
G4 connection.
Allman-esque G4 connection that I'll mention in a moment. But
oh, I was there. I remember.
Well, I remember when I was a creative director at the website, and one day you came in my office just for a second. You went, hey, Joe, and left, right? And then 5 seconds later, Weird Al walks by and goes, hey, Joe, and walks out.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
So random, yet that made my year. But it's one of those moments where I went like, I would never have that otherwise. You know, I would never get that chance. You know, it was a magical moment, and I thank you for that.
Well, please, but, you were tucked away in the digital department.
Yes. Yep.
So you weren't in my normal lane of traffic.
Because he was shooting something that day. I think he was shooting something with Al in the a closet that was like off to the side.
Oh, yes, we were shooting Web Soup. The season finale where we get trapped in a utility closet, and it's a flashback episode.
Yeah, flashback to all the other episodes.
Yeah,
we did that year.
And and Sarah Underwood was in there, and I just remember some joke where I'm like, well, we're all alone, and she's like, and I go, you know, I was on Singled Out with Jenny McCarthy, and she goes, ew, how old are you?
But again, like, that's just knowing, like, that I had this connection with you from the Singled Out days, you know, because I remember when that show first came on, that was like, you were us. You know, like you represented us in a way.
What, guys who were largely ignored for more attractive people?
Yes.
Okay.
And then later on, when you were in House of 1,000 Corpses, I was like, holy fuck, there's Hardwick again. You know, like, and you're working with Rob Zombie. This is fucking nuts. You know, and then you got to do the ultimate Dr. Satan, that like shit that we quoted for fucking years, you know, and then, you know, when I was at G4, and then I think, it was right when Web Soup had started, and you'd like just walk past my office and went, was that fucking Hardwick? Holy shit, damn, he looks good. Yeah. whatever diet he's on, I want some of that.
I'm on the no booze diet. Not drinking till 4 a.m. and then eating half a pizza.
That doesn't suit quite well for the social outlook.
I spent so much money at Damiano's Pizza because they would deliver it to the west side, and it was expensive.
They would deliver that far?
Yeah, but it was expensive. It was like $40 for a pizza.
Jeez.
And I didn't really have much money back then, so I didn't care. And they would do it. And then a lot of times I would see all these charges on my credit card from Damiano's. I'm like, I didn't order Damiano's. And I realized I would get home hammered, order the pizza, pass out. They would try to deliver it, and I wouldn't answer the door, so they would just charge me anyway and take the pizza back.
Oh, Jesus.
So,
dude.
Yeah.
Was the pizza good?
I wasn't. Well, it was delicious when I was.
When it was in your mouth, of course.
Yeah, but yeah. Damiano's got run out of. They got shut down
because by the animals.
Yeah, because Fairfax, that stretch of Fairfax got all gentrified with fucking high
awesome
end
restaurants.
And yeah. High end like, sneaker stores.
And stuff
yep,
like that?
Right yeah. Across the street. Damiano's yeah. was like. Damiano's was good, but it was very dark, and it was a place where you did not ever want them to turn the lights on.
Yeah.
Because it just had a
there's
weird.
A new
what was it like
place.
Pee Wee's Big Adventure and like all animals?
Yeah,
like,
yeah pretty much.
Like
yeah.
There's a good pizza place up there that the guys who, I guess they're the animal guys too. They don't. No, it's the guys that own.
Chappies?
Yep, Chappies.
Chappies? Let's go to Chappies for the finest in South Africa.
They own the burger place and the Kofax, which is a great breakfast place. We want a breakfast burrito. And then they have a pizza place, I think, called Prime Pizza that's fucking really good.
Okay.
Like, but is it like pizza. New York style
yeah.
pizza? Really?
Yeah.
Because there was a place
oh,
on Melrose.
New York style
hey,
pizza.
Fucking
are you talking my pizza? Some of that New York, Chicago deep dish Philly
don't
style
you talk
pizza.
About Chicago, Philly pizza.
You guys, the
Bacazze.
I really set myself up for that one. God damn it.
Hey, Papangu.
Damn it. I really set myself up for that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry about that.
We just.
I should
you know
what
you were talking about.
Tropes.
Hey, burrito! Burritos!
You're talking about. I took a left.
I was so tempted to bring a burrito with me. How many times has someone brought a burrito for the final moment?
Zero times.
Fuck! I sat there going, I know fucking Bridges did it at least the second or third time. Like,
no.
You know he brought a fucking. No one?
No.
Nope.
Shit. All right. Well, hopefully in 5 years, I'll get the Joe Lynch returns.
I feel like actually,
I will bring a burrito for
literally
everyone.
The only time we've ever had burritos after a podcast was that first year at Comic-Con when Matt Smith and Karen Gillan handed out burritos.
Yeah, that's not true. There was another time. There was another time when we went to Honest Taqueria in Boston.
That wasn't all of us, Chris.
No. I didn't go with you.
You
I
did.
Never went with you.
I thought you did.
No. You just
well, it wasn't
a
after
up.
A podcast.
You did a tweet up. It was after a comedy show. You did a stand-up.
Oh.
I told
anyway,
you
that
go
was
there.
That was good. Sorry, you guys.
But having that edict of enjoy your burrito, I never, like, when I first listened to the show, I guess, you know, I think this was like maybe the 200s or 300s, you know. in the 200s era.
300.
But that time, I guess, you didn't explain it as much, and it would just kind of come up at the end. And then I can't remember who it was that you explained it to, but then I went, fuck, that is such good advice. Now, to bring it back to Serbia, they don't have very good burritos out there.
What?
No.
Shockingly, not very good burritos, but the fucking sushi is fantastic.
That makes sense.
Right? Serbian sushi?
You like to go to Serbia for sushi.
I'm just mixing up all these. There's no way in.
Just can't
weird
figure
Euro
out
trash accent accents. Doesn't match. I'm talking about sushi.
Ruben, that was my favorite.
So, hey, what
thing?
Are you doing with your sushi?
Like, it doesn't
is that an Italian crab?
Kind of.
I just felt like I was in Belgrade again, though.
Da, 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 da.
Hey, I eat. Oh, you eat my claw.
So he's giving himself to you.
I'll grow on the back. It's man, okay.
You must have been really funny earlier in the day because it's all petered out.
I'm glad you saved yourself for me. I know I'm not Prince, but hopefully I'm an appropriate
Wait, are we getting Prince on the podcast?
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Come on. I'm trying to do a callback to a couple weeks ago.
No, but that'd be fantastic.
Well, it really would
I
be
just
fantastic.
I wouldn't want Prince, you know? I had to drive in, this was like 87 or 88, and my mom, who was obsessed with Prince, she would tell me on a daily basis, I'm leaving your father for Prince. And this was the Under the Cherry Moon
era. Mommy's just going to sleep with you.
Like, I even told her that. I'm like, he's just going to bang you and leave. You know this, right? He's so small, he can crawl up your vagina.
Right.
You know, like, you do realize that there are some limitations.
I'm inside now.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably right. He was having a show at Madison Square. Get off. I can't help it. Ever since fucking Aukerman started doing that.
Tell your son to go away.
I haven't stopped listening to that album since you guys started doing that.
So wait, so what was this? Your mom was upset.
Going into telling my dad that she's gonna leave him for Prince. scaring the shit out of everybody because Prince was the hottest thing going at that point. So we went into New York City to go to Madison Square Garden. This was like right before Ticketmaster kind of took over everything and everybody had to wait at a video store to get tickets. So we had to drive all the way into New York City.
Video store? What's a video?
I know. Sorry. Calling my agent right now. But we went to Madison Square Garden. That's where you had to have it. And for some weird reason, I was obsessed. Because I was in New York City, I had this obsession over getting a Freddy Krueger poster. I don't know where it came from. So my mom was obsessed with Prince. She had to get a fucking tickets for Prince. And I was on a one-track mission to get... This was Friday... No, I'm sorry. Nightmare 2. Like, in between Nightmare 2 and Nightmare 3.
Freddy's the prince of child murdering.
Hey, he's the bastard son of a thousand children.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like, or maniacs or whatever.
A bastard son of a thousand maniacs. Yeah,
bastard son of 10,000 maniacs. Drummer,
the band. he's a bastard son of Natalie Merchant.
Yeah. That would be a fantastic
Amanda
mythology.
Kruger. Like, yeah, Amanda Kruger was played by Natalie Merchant.
Tell that to the Platinum Dunes guys. I'm sure they'll work that into the next remake.
That's why she came up with the song "What's the Matter Here?" because she was all about her son Freddy Krueger, who was abusing children.
Ooh.
Oh.
Okay, we need to get Michael Bay on the phone.
Abusing. Right. Very nice way of saying
Michael
that.
Michael Bay.
Weirdly enough, I found that motherfucking poster.
Like, nice.
It was in 40, because that was when 42nd Street, it was all, you know, bodegas,
yeah,
which I learned later that were all drug fronts thanks to Half Baked. I had no fucking clue. I was just like, there's a lot of stereos here. This is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have all those, you know, they would just have posters in the back. And shockingly, I found one. And so we went home very happy because my mom got Prince tickets, I got a Freddy poster. And the only other thing I can remember from that trip is, you know, I was a pretty innocent gentleman back then. And we're walking down 42nd Street and my mom goes, she saw one of the ladies of the night strolling around and she goes, "Do you know what that is?" I'm like, "No." She goes, "That's a prostitute." "Do you know what that is?" I'm fucking 11. And I go, "Is that some kind of Democrat?" I had no clue what a prostitute was or B what a Democrat was at that point. I was probably
until
watching
she got
the news
one
or
for you
like
to make your
and
man.
Then it was just like, yeah, you know, Harmony Korine and his dad with kids. She got me a hooker and the rest is history.
Yeah.
So, and that's where the career was born. Thankfully.
I'm so curious about how you ended up like what your time in the pornography.
Oh, we're going back to that.
Well,
it was 28 days. And
later.
I'm going to tell you a story of... Oh, God, am I going to tell this story? Oh, fuck. I'm sorry, Katie. You might have to cut this out. Okay. So I got this job. It was the only job I can get at the time. And the cruel irony of it was they gave me... At the time, it was a G4 power book, like power tower, whatever. It was like one of those really fancy Mac, you know...
Mirador drives or...
It was the power PC, you know, but it was that, and it was a 20-inch screen and everything. It was like... I could be making features on this thing. No, I'm looking at gaping assholes for the next 8 hours
nice.
Or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, it was Quicksilver at the time. And the way that they had it all positioned is it's this one very dark, very lonely room that they have 7 or 8 guys in all the corners just sitting there up against workstations and just cutting away, right? No one says a word, right? There would be the occasional moments where someone would be like, and they would like stand up and go to the bathroom for about 4 or 5 minutes, and you didn't ever.
Oh, for
flush.
Was there a
for research? Yes, research.
I am curious. Yeah. Is there like an edict from them of like the formula to cutting porn?
Yes.
Of like you want this, then this, yep, then this, that long on that.
It was a very strict formula.
Uh-huh.
That. It was.
It's blowjob, conilingus, two positions, cum shot. I used to have a. I had it out.
Sadly,
like
two all beef patties, pickle.
Use a special sauce.
Special sauce is the last thing.
Yeah, the lettuce cheese was actually synonymous
on your
with
sesame seed buns.
It was actually a Cleveland steamer.
That
but,
really
yeah.
works.
It really. Oh my God,
guys,
Burger King
I
is fun for porn.
The real formula.
No. All they would say was they would give you a mini DV tape.
Yeah,
because all the guy would do, like the director would just shoot, and that's it. And all they would say is, take out the pussy farts. take out the direction. That was the only formula that I had. You know.
Huh.
And also
that's Chaplin used to have to do the same
sorry.
Thing.
I had to make sure that every project was
crap.
You know,
crap.
Chappie too queefs.
What they're taking out though is the sound is just a card that says brap on it.
It was more of a. So to bide the time, I started collecting all of these bloopers, right? Bloopers of guys who looked like Jason Statham who would inject their dicks to get hard.
Oh,
know?
No.
Bloopers, is that when a girl
shits on you.
No, that's a blumpy.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sorry. She said that I was quick to know that. But if there was a blumpy blooper, I think we would have. I
love TV's
there.
Blumpies and Practical Jokers.
Every time Dick Clark would just drop one on Ed, oh, it'd be fantastic.
Ed, I'm going to blow you now while you shit.
Hoo-ah! So they would have all these guys and no one would talk to each other, and you would just kind of, you would be handed a stack of DV tapes by this really such a sweet old lady who would come, like not come, she would approach your desk. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm not going to drop, I'm going to fall into that joke, but she would come over by your desk, ew, and she would hand you some tapes, and then you would just put, digitize it, cut it all up, and then you would export it. And everybody who was there was just kind of used to it. Like, you just become desensitized. I would actually put a Post-it on the top of my screen, so I would focus on that instead of looking at the worst atrocities I've ever seen.
Does it make having sex, like...
I would go home every night, and my wife would, even if she like looked at me funny, I'd go, get the fuck away from me. Yeah. I'm so sorry. This sounds awful, but I'm only going to disappoint you.
I jerked off 4 times at work today. I'm no use to you.
Dude, my sex drive went to nothing. I got an innie. Essentially,
I worked in the ice cream store, and then I just didn't want ice cream anymore.
Right. Yeah. This is too much ice cream. Right? That's a lot of cream. Way too much cream for me.
Yeah,
I became sexually lactose intolerant.
You should.
Maybe it'll work for him. It worked for Sam Malone.
So there was a guy, the guy that I was talking about before, the one with the Emmy, right? This guy with Emmy was our supervisor, and his whole big claim to fame was that he worked on Enterprise, right? And everyone was like, oh my God, Enterprise, that's amazing. Wow, you're a genius.
Well, the worst of the Star Trek franchise?
Well, at the time, though, it was still like, oh, give Bakula another season. He might turn this thing around.
They did start to pull it out.
Right?
In season 4.
Speaking of pull out, one day... So
on your back, you
on
love.
My 28th day, so I can claim that I spent 28 days later on this. They handed me all my tapes, and I'm sitting there, I'm trudging through, and there was this gentleman that no one ever spoke to each other. It was just one of those things where it's like, it's probably better off if we just don't talk. Like this, not something you sit over by, the water cooler, like, so how's your day going? Yeah. Oh my God.
You should see this Dutch angle I'm working on.
You should see this montage. Oh my God, the mise-en-scene in this shot.
Yeah. I'm working on this queef supercut of just all of the ones that were taken out.
So all the ones that we had.
Yeah.
Not a lot of conversation going on, but there was this one gentleman who was just Silent Bob. He was the guy on the couch, right? Like, no one ever talked to him. He would just come and do his thing, and that was it. Every once in a while, you'd hear somebody go like, oh, shit, and then people would be like, oh, what, and there would be a curiosity involved. Because it would take a lot for anybody to say, oh, shit, and then make everybody go over there and look like, how does that, like, everyone's twisting their necks like, how does that happen? Like, how do people actually perform like that? So, oh, boy. So one day, we're all there, it's a silent, and then you heard from Mr. Silence, oh, my God. Within 3 seconds, everybody crowded around.
Sure.
Like, it's like a dirty limerick. This I gotta see, So now, if you're familiar, and this goes back to the formula, if we're all aware of the adult entertainment, you have to have something called the pop shot or the money shot or the climax.
Right.
Every good film needs a climax. Well, porn does too.
Right.
You need to have a climax in every single scene, or it doesn't become a scene. It doesn't go out. You don't get paid. So if by some chance, Frederick Fast and Hard doesn't, quite get it up, or he comes too early or whatever, then you have to go back and find a compatible dick to fit into that shot. So you'd have to go back to Frederick's old filmography, if you will.
Oh, crazy.
And find something that kind of fits. So there, you need to have that. So here's a scene unfolds. It's a scene, you're atypical. It's in the valley. It's a pool scene, and we're getting to the climax. And the female in the scene, the actress in the scene, is fellating our star, so to speak, and finishing off the scene. And we're like, okay, seen this a million times. What's the big deal? He goes, just wait. So, so he pulls out and he's going to climax, and it was like Crimson Tide. He sprayed blood all over
her face.
Oh
my God.
How? Why?
And immediately, the guy behind me goes, syphilis!
Oh!
It gets worse.
It's pretty bad at this point.
It gets worse.
Guys, I'm so fucking hard right now.
It's funny because that guy behind me said the same thing. I'm like, no, I don't want to hear that right now behind me. Sorry. So, you know, and the worst part, well, this is not the worst part. One of the worst parts is that the girl kept her eyes closed, so she had no clue. So she's just like, she's going like, paycheck. No. I just got to fill out a form and that's it. She had no clue. And then the tape ends. And everyone's did exactly what we all did. Oh, shit, damn! And then
did your phone ring and someone goes,
7 days. I wish they did because I wanted to kill myself afterwards.
Oh.
And then the supervisor comes out, of course, clutching his Emmy, and he's like, what's going on here? You know, and puts it down and, you know, like, oh, show me the scene. So we show it to him, and we're all looking at him like, so what happens? Like, does the guy have to go back and try to find something? Like, because this was, oh, this the other thing was, this was a new female, so we couldn't find the actress that would be compatible with the guy. The guy had been working for, like, at least a year, right?
Oh.
I remember because I would go over there and go like, I know that dick. So the guy goes, so the supervisor goes like, oh, okay. He treated it like it was like a glitch, you know, like, oh shit, that's 23.98, not 22.7. All right. So he goes, oh, send me the shot. So
the no, he's going to color correct it.
No!
No!
No! 30 minutes later.
No! He just starts coming the NX-01.
It's just 30 minutes later, thanks to Adobe After Effects, that crimson spray turned a pearly white.
That might be the most disgusting thing that's ever happened on this podcast.
I knew I would make an impression. I knew I would make an impression.
Holy shit.
And then, now I'm sitting there going, was this allowed? Like, is this, like, this is, now, this was right before there was this big disease scare in, like, the industry.
Did someone warn? Did someone give okay. that girl a heads up?
Well, gave her a head something. That's I don't know, but.
I like to imagine he went back in and pulled out his own files and just made him shoot a phaser out of his dick.
I was expecting laser beams and shit, like lightning bolt. You know?
Emmy, bro.
That would have been at least, then he would have justified his Emmy. So he sends the shot back and we all sit there like, are you fucking kidding me? And then I went back to my desk and went, I know this guy. And I looked at the previous tapes and, because the thing is, you're supposed to get tested. You have to get tested. He didn't get tested. And I looked back in my log and he had been working on, because that was like, say, you know, August 13th. I went back to my desk and looked at all the tapes and went, oh my God, that guy worked on 9/13, 9/17, 10/1. He worked on at least 8 projects after that.
Why wouldn't someone have reported him after?
That's what I said. And I was like, I'm done. Like, if I ever needed an excuse to get the fuck out that it's not worth it for the money, and we were fucking broke, I was like, that's it. Like, I'm done. You know, like, I have a very questionable moral line, but that was where it crossed it. You know, so that was my short stint in porn, and,
that's
and
so brutal.
I've never looked back. So
that is, but it got you to pursue.
It pushed me out and said, you know what? It might have been easy to, you know, to collect a paycheck or whatever, but just keep going. You know, so I just. When I was in New York,
you know, I really like, quick, and not to throw you under the bus, Matt, but you've been smiling this entire time, and it's creeping me the fuck out. The fact that you've like barely reacted to one of the most horrible things any of us have ever heard of.
Well, I mean, it just that tracks with me of like what they would do. That all just tracks.
Not so much talking about the change in the color, just more of the fact that a guy syphilised all over a girl's face and then continued to work.
Don't make it a verb. Yeah, sift.
Don't syphilis.
A holy
verb?
Sifter.
Yeah.
No.
I'm sorry,
Katie. I'm so sorry, yes. Katie. I'm so, so sorry.
I'm sorry if I...
You've heard worse?
Well, I mean, not worse. Not...
But I'm just saying, like, I'm sorry if, like, I'm not surprised by the moral compass of the guy coming on the girl's face of that he would do that with syphilis.
It's,
of course, he would.
Have you?
I really wanted my mom to listen to this episode.
Blood on a girl's face?
No. Why? I mean, I've not heard of it. I mean, I've heard of it now that Joe's here.
It's just, this is really weirding me out. You're just like, yeah. And then they killed babies. Okay, I can see that. What? It's not outside the moral compass for these people to kill babies.
They have a business.
Okay, so to recap already, we've talked newborn porn. We've gotten Bloody Spooge out of the way.
Yeah.
So we're going down a very good course, I feel.
Yeah. I've brought it up, I think, a couple times where I've always waited for you to be on the podcast to have you talk about it. But how much can you talk about what went down with Knights of Badassdom?
Oh, I don't give a fuck now. You guys can ask whatever.
Well, I want you to just tell a story about how, like, everything.
Oh,
like,
shit. I just opened up Pandora's box.
Yeah. Well, you know, with that said, I just. You've told me some stuff here and there in piecemeal, and you always.
And now I'm going to react, okay?
Now I'm just going to get grumpy face, you know? Talk about the Brooklyn bloodline, I'll get really happy. Yeah, but then
now,
you talk
now
about.
That money
wait, I
thought
it was the Brooklyn spooge line. Or
it's an immediate callback.
It's
a good one. Too soon,
I
bro.
I liked it.
I appreciate it.
All right, Knights of Badassdom. It started out with the best of intentions. You know, when you have when I read the script, I was like, "This is a movie for me." You know, but I didn't see like the way that it was written. Matt Wall and Kevin Dreyfuss, these two producers who worked on this at this one company, wrote this script. It was a passion project for them. And when I read it, I went, all right, this is everything that I love in movies. You know, it felt like an adventure movie. You know, everyone kept saying when they were pitching it, like, it's a horror comedy. I'm like, it is, but it's more of like, do you remember in the 80s when like Romancing the Stone was out, where you'd have a little bit of everything? You'd have, you know, action and
adventure,
drama and
romance.
You know, yeah. A little bit of horror. Like, my God, that ending of Romancing the Stone when the fucking crocodile bites his hand. That's not PG-13.
It's not a laugh out loud moment.
That's serious R-rated moment, you know, and I remember it really affecting me. But the fact that Zemeckis was able to balance everything out, he's a master at that, you know, able to balance all those different genres into one thing. But it felt to me it was its own genre. It was an adventure movie. So I went in and pitched it as an adventure film, and it was we were on board. It took, God, like almost 3 years to get the kind of the ship sailing. You know, at that point, I started in 2008. We didn't know 2007, 2008. We didn't actually shoot until 2010. And at that point, I mean, you know, we got Dinklage was the first on board, and this was right before he went to go shoot Game of Thrones, which fucked us later on. So I love me some Game of Thrones, but they can also go fuck themselves because they stole my actor. But we had Dinklage, and then from Dinklage, everybody just kind of fell into place. You know, Quentin came on, and Steve Zahn came on, and Summer Glau, and Jimmy Simpson. I mean, Danny Pudi. I was like, I am the luckiest guy in the world. I have, you know, the Ocean's 11 of Comic-Con. You know, like this was to me. This was my way to say I love this genre. You know, with all these actors, and everybody was on board. I told the story before. I think at Comic-Con when we got everybody together, it was very important that we had LARP training, you know, because half the cast didn't know what LARPing was. So we had these experts from California go up to where was it? Spokane, Washington, and give LARP training. So you know, imagine, like, you know, you have Steve and Summer and Ryan and Tom Hopper, who was Gunther at the time, who's on Black Sails now. You know, all these people and Dinklage, and everybody's holding a foam sword, you know, and then the guy's like, okay, everybody, let's just spar a little bit. And they put everybody in a circle, and I guess everybody was to kind of turn to their partner and just start.
Ow.
Okay. You know, point. Dinklage took it upon himself to basically put himself in the center of the room. And I swear to God, he went thwap, 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 dropped the sword and went, Narnia. In that perfect Peter deadpan, like not even a wink. And he just went over to his table and like started taking a drink, like, all right, motherfuckers, I just mic dropped, you know. It was amazing. Everybody was so on board with this movie. And then it slowly just started to unravel. Like it was like that bottle. Like when we first, you know, the movie was made by this company called IndieVest, and it's a company that goes out to like basically find investors from all walks of life with the promise that if you invest in this movie, you get to be on set, you get, you know, name in the credits, you get to go to Sundance, you get to go to the premiere, like you become a Hollywood.
How could that blow up in someone's face?
Right? I know. How could this go wrong? So, you know, I was told when I left for the shoot. This was in May of 2010. They were like, okay, we are, I think it was like 6.5 million, right? 6.57. I'm like, fucking healthy. That's a healthy budget for something like this. Gives me enough, especially when you go to like to Spokane, it gives you enough to be able to play with where you're not, you know, killing yourself because you just don't have enough time or the resources. We were able to get Spectral Motion, who did all of Del Toro's movies, like Pan's Labyrinth and the Hellboy movies. You know, they're monster geniuses. And I sorry to name drop here, but I had Del Toro call them on my behalf. So being on that call, and he's like, "These fucking cocksucker is fucking crazy, man. You got to fucking work with him." And that was it. And they were like, "All right, well, he sounds like a cocksucker, so I guess we're going to work with him." So we had the DP from The Descent and Doomsday, Sam McCurdy. Jeez. Like, I really had like the perfect team to make this movie as good as possible. Left Los Angeles and the budget was like 6.5. Touched down and it went from 6.5 to 4. And again, like, you know, you sit there and go, rolling with the punches, I'll make it work. Little did I know later on, and I found this out because an investor contacted me years later when everything started going down and was like, "Did you know how much you really had? You actually had like 1.75 million. Yeah. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. I don't know where that money went. I have no clue. But suddenly, like when we were going through prep, it was like, well, you could have had this, or, you know, well, we can't really do a company move. So everything in that movie takes place in one fucking field. And we just had to redress it over and over and over again because we couldn't afford to make a company move. And that was, you sit there and go, where's the money? I thought we had production value. There's vans and we have breakfast burritos. Like, well, why can't we go elsewhere? And it was nuts. And I got so bad. I've actually never talked about this. So we're going to get kind of marin-y here. Sorry.
That's okay.
I'll get
Nerdisty like plenty of times, but when I went out there, I was nervous as fuck. Like this was like, I had done Wrong Turn 2 and you know, that fared really well for me. I didn't expect it to do as well as it did. And it did. And I remember saying to myself, like, all right, I got to step up, you know, like we got to kind of move ahead. I got to find a story that I really want to tell, but also do it in a way that feels like, ah, okay, now we're going from point A to point B in the career. And then I'll be sitting in Kevin Feige's office any day now. But I was so nervous that I got on Zoloft, right? And if you're familiar with Zoloft, it's like the, you know, little kind of oval blue pills, and you take half of it, you know, and that's usually what's good. When I got there, I was like, fuck it, why not? It'll just calm my nerves. It'll just help me kind of focus through the day.
Is this an anti-anxiety?
Yeah.
Okay.
And because I was having like panic attacks because I felt like everything, I've wanted to do this since I was 2 or 3, you know, and to get to this moment, I psyched myself out. I totally psyched myself out. I put so much pressure on myself that never really went out. You know, when everyone's like, oh, let's go hang out, I was like, nope, got to go inside. I got to do my shot list. I got to do my storyboards. I got to prep. And by doing that, I like took the fun out of it in a way, I guess. You know, it just became so nerve-wracking to me because I felt like every single choice I make, I'm going to have to justify for the next 30 years. Mm. Because once you put it on film, it's it. That's it. It's done. It's out there. It's not your movie anymore. So every moment counts. So I started taking like a little half of Zoloft, you know, once a day just to kind of get me up and at 'em and good. Midway through production, when shit was just fucking hitting the fan, when you shoot in Spokane, no one told us this, but when you shoot in Spokane, there's a few limitations. Like, for example, when you shoot in the summer and you're making a movie that's set mostly at night, mostly outdoors, don't shoot a movie in Spokane because, and I love those people, but don't shoot a movie where your nighttime consists of 10:30 p.m. to 4 a.m. and that's it. So our call times every day would be 5 o'clock and then we'd wrap at 6. I would block the scene out with the crew and the cast. And then we would go to lunch for 5 hours.
Oh.
5 hours gone. That's money just gone. People waiting around, people playing Xbox in their trailers or whatever. Shit. And I'm sitting there on this field going, I'm going to fucking die. Like, and everything's coming down on me, you know. It was horrible, you know. So my first AD actually kind of figured it all out. We technically had 30 days to shoot it, like on paper. We had 30 days to shoot it. All the hours lost, all the time that was, you know, spent waiting around for 10:30 to happen, and then race to get everything that you're supposed to get in 12 hours and 6. We actually had 17 days to shoot that movie. Mm. It was heartbreaking. So that half a Zoloft turned into a whole Zoloft, and then that whole Zoloft turned into two Zoloft. And I would actually have them in my pocket just like when the next shitstorm would come and I'd have to put out a fire or whatever. I'd be like, okay, boop.
Well, that made everything okay, right?
No, it made my pink. Oh. No, it made my both of my pinkies go numb.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
The weirdest thing. Like, I sat there and went like,
yeah, that was being sarcastic, by the way. Of course, it's a terrible thing to have to.
But it was just, I thought it would have helped, and it made it so much worse. Like, it really did. It was, like, it was horrible because I couldn't be in the moment because I kind of leveled myself out. And I look back and I go, like, would I have fought for more things if I was, like, more, not to say that I wasn't on point. I made my days and I did it. But the lack of joy, I guess, because I sedated myself during that was awful. It made me not appreciate the process. It made me, like, forget why I love doing this.
At least you learned that, though, and repeat that over
no,
and over
No, no,
no.
I've never, like, the second that I left Spokane, when we were done, I left the bottle in the hotel, and I never took another one.
So you, so when you cut the movie together, after you took out all the queefs, did you, did you, thanks, Joe. Did you,
that gets a tee-hee.
Did you, were you happy or sad or like, fuck, this isn't what I wanted to do? Or
it was one of those situations where when you're on a production, you'll have the producers go like, don't worry, we'll get that later. You know, like we'll get that insert shot or we'll get that moment when we're back in LA. We, you know, like we can shoot it on a, at the time, you know, you could, it was just when 5Ds were starting to be used in movies. So they're like, oh yeah, you know what? We have a 5D. We can just shoot that tire or get that shot of the book or whatever. So I left Spokane going like, I think I got some good stuff. I felt like, you know, I got to Spokane going, I'm going to make the next Goonies. And I left saying, I think we made Mac and Me, you know. No. That's not fair. That's not fair. More like The Wrong Guys. Remember The Wrong Guys with Richard Lewis and Tim Thomerson
who
played the old Cub Scouts?
Yes.
Right? Yeah, there's one for the canon. I left going like, okay, I know I have something good. But fuck, I got like hampered every step of the way. Like it was just constant compromise every single day. And I just kind of had to deal with it. So we had this amazing editor, Howard Smith, who did The Abyss. He did this is fucking nuts. He was the editor on Twilight Zone, the movie.
Oh, wow.
During the big Landis debacle. So he was the guy who was called at 4 a.m. because he was the one who had to set up the Steenbeck to go through the footage with the FBI.
Oh my gosh.
Oh fuck.
Yeah. How fucked up is
and
that?
And he did Knights of Badassdom.
And he did Knights of Badassdom. So imagine the awkward moment when I had John Landis come into the edit room and sit there and watch the movie. And I'm like, hey, this is Howard Smith. And there was this kind of like moment between them. Oh my God. It was what am I going to leave now? It was awful, you know, but Howard was awesome, and he, you know, he was my champion the whole way.
John? Howard?
Yeah.
Well, let's watch this thing.
You guys remember Vic Morrow? No?
I'm, like, more affected by that than the coming blood.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But could you imagine being the guy that's got to go through this raw footage? And I've seen it. You know, like
I've seen
ago,
it, too, yeah.
And it's the worst, you know.
Lower!
But, right? Like, yeah. And, you know, and I've become friends with John, and, you know, it's something that... You know, he's got to live with every day of his life for the rest of his life. Like, there are people in this town who will not work with him because they call him a murderer. I'm like, that happened in 87. He was, you know, he was cleared of the crime, but the people will not forget it, you know. Well, so anyway.
Isn't that when, around the same time, like, Spielberg kind of backed off from him?
Yeah, when that happened, it was just like...
Spielberg, the rumor is that Spielberg was on set when that happened.
Yeah, the rumor was that
was
the second
carted
it happened,
away immediately.
He was shoved into a limo, and that was the last that anybody had seen of him, you know?
Yeah.
And Landis had to kind of take the brunt of it. So
and
anyway...
Wasn't there a weird thing where, like, Joe Dante defended Landis, and then, like, that's when Spielberg stopped working with Joe Dante as well?
Well, no, that can't be, though, because Gremlins was, like, right after that.
Was that right after that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, sorry.
So maybe, you know. Well, let's just say that Spielberg has not been to any of the Masters of Horror dinners.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, Wim Wenders and Michael Mann have.
Oh, Jesus.
But strangely enough, Spielberg. Weirdly enough. So anyway, so we're in the post-process. Everything's going great. The script for Everly got on the blacklist, so I was like, woohoo, guns a-blazing. And then one day, everything that I do in my life is it all comes down to the release dates of movies. You name a movie, I could probably like name the release date. So Battle, what was it? Battle LA came out on March 11th of 2011. And I remember going like, ooh, I can't wait because the Super Bowl ad was fucking great. Everybody was psyched for it. And then we went into the edit and we were all going to go to the movies right after. And then we got the call like, yeah, we're shutting down the edit. I'm like, okay, is everything all right? Oh, yeah, yeah. We're just, you know, we're just looking to, you know, find some funds elsewhere to keep you guys going. And okay, how long? Well, you know, we'll let you know. And I just knew from there that it would like things were going rotten in Denmark. So I remember sitting in Battle LA at the Dome, practically crying, like, it's over. Sure. Somebody thought that I was crying because of the movie. I'm like, it's not the movie. I swear. It's not. And that's not how Santa Monica's laid out. I don't know where they are. And then, you know, one or two weeks turned into 1 or 2 months, and then 2 months turned into 4. And then
Of nothing. Where you're not hearing from anyone.
Radio silence until June of like it was so for, like 3 or 4 months of nothing. And then I had said from the beginning when we were shooting, you know, because we lost Danny, Summer, I think Ryan as well for like a whole weekend because of Comic-Con. And my producer's like, what the fuck? You know, they weren't really as, like, at least one of them was didn't really know about Comic-Con. I'm like, dude, no, this is good. Let them go to Comic-Con. Like, you need to, this is a comic, I even said, like, this is a Comic-Con movie. Like, this is a movie that we're making that is going to hopefully, you know, touch the, you know, the hearts of that kind of crowd. Because that's us. That's me, you know. And this is good for us. You know, like, let them go. And then, you know, say, like, May or something like that, Comic-Con came to us and said, like, oh, we heard about this movie. You know, are you guys interested in promoting it there? And then I reached out again, like, yes, like, definitely. And then, shockingly, who would have thought we got Hall H on Saturday afternoon?
That's crazy.
Wow. Like, that's as big as it gets, right?
It is the biggest hall. I mean, just for, I would assume people know if they listen to the podcast, but it is basically prime time, center stage, biggest 7,000 people.
It's like a football field.
Yeah. The biggest movies, the biggest television shows, like the biggest A-list everything. Hall H.
That's where everybody goes. And, you know, thankfully, I personally called all the cast and said, look, you know, if you're, most of them were actually going to Comic-Con, you know, so Dinklage was there for Game of Thrones and Ryan was there for True Blood and Summer was there, I think, for Terminator at the time or like something right. Summer was just going because she's Summer Glau, you know, she's set. But we had like most of the cast there and they're like, yeah, we would love to come. So because we had the cast and, you know, because of the nature of the movie, they were like, yeah, we'll give you, I think it was, we were in between the Immortals and Snow White and the Huntsman. Mm. Now, again, who the fuck were we? You know, Knights of Badass, and what the hell is that? But it was still, it was either people who were, I think, waiting for, still reeling from that Twixt movie that Coppola did where they made everybody wear the Poe faces, you know, so there's a bunch of, so weird to walk around Hall H and looking and you're stepping on Edgar Allan Poe's face. You know, it's really strange. Only in Comic-Con. So they were reeling from that, but then either they were, you know, waiting, because you know how people like wait all day, you know, for like the end. So we had a bunch of people who were waiting there, or they're big Tarsem fans because of the Immortals, or Snow White, which everybody was excited for. And then and then we did the panel. And I'd gone to Hall H as a fan. I had gone to Hall H as, you know, for G4 before. So I knew full well what it's like to be in Hall H, just not from that perspective.
Right.
So I don't know why, but like when I was shooting the movie, the props master gave me a real like LARPing sword, like one that's like sanctioned by LARP. You know, they have like physical people who sit there and go like, this is good. Okay, moving on.
Physical people is my favorite 80s band.
Yeah. So this was an authentic LARPing sword that I named after my grandmother, Edith, right? So I brought it with me to Comic-Con, and the LARPing alliance that was down there, they all went down there. We had real LARPers in the movie who came from California, Budapest, Florida, New York, Canada. They were just like, you're making a LARP movie? See you there. And the people just stayed for free. So all those same people were like, of course we're going to go to Comic-Con. So they set up this big LARPing thing outside. Wow. They brought in like a whole faction and did this thing like right before. It was perfect, you know. And I went out there and I had the sword like in a sheath behind me. And I was the first one out. And when I walked out and you look at 7,000 people at you, you know, it's fucking daunting, you know, but I said, fuck it. Why not? So, so we all had a great time on there, even though I think, Margarita LaViva, who was also in, the last Bond film too, she was in the film and she spoiled Dinklage's death.
like during the panel, she's like, oh yeah, like you don't make it long, you know, you don't last long in the movie. And the whole place went, oh no. And Dinklage is just like, what am I gonna do, you know? So at the end of the panel, and I just sat there, it was just reeling, because it felt like that moment in Rocky where he gets up to the steps and he's bouncing around and then they freeze frame. You know, like that to me was my Rocky freeze frame. So I was like, I'm taking this moment, fuck it. So I grabbed the sword, pull it out, and I just went, huzzah! 7,000 people said huzzah back.
Wow. Yes.
And really, it was like, da-na-na-na. And then I was frozen in time. Yeah. And then I was frozen in time for another year almost. Oh. It was that moment where I was like, and that was where it, I shouldn't say it all went downhill, but that was the last like great moment for that, for me at least, because right after that, I was in this sitcom with another filmmaker, Adam Green, who I do a podcast with, this show called Holliston. It's a horror comedy sitcom. Don't ask. It's nuts. But we were starting.
Dee Snider lives in the closet.
No. It's Odorous Urungus.
That's right. Odorous Urungus. Yeah.
The late great Odorous Urungus. Dee Snider played our androgynous boss. We can't tell if he's a guy or he's a girl. He's amazing.
Which is why I said he lives in the closet.
Fucking point taken, sir. My God, we have two characters that live in the closet.
It's not why he said it.
I'm going to give you points for that. Points.
Thank you.
Get points. I'll take that as points.
I give points. You don't give points. What are you doing?
Vicarious points. Dude, you started that, because now that's all I do. I walk around and like my kid will like, hey, look, I wipe my ass. Points. Nah. You know, like, thank you.
I do that with these guys. Aww. I give them points for wiping their ass.
So anyway,
never wipe your ass.
So after that, you know, speaking of wiping asses, so after that, it like I went off and did Holliston, and I met with the head of the company again. He's like, so we fired those old producers who I had a perfectly good time with. They were cool. They were on my side. We're like, so we got rid of those guys, and we're going to bring it back to your vision. You know, we had some restructuring. We got the money back. We got some money. So what we're going to do is we hired this new producer and a new editor, and we're going to start on it. We have all your notes. And I'm sitting there going like, fuck, cool, all right, you know, let's see what happens. That was in September, and they was like, 6 weeks. 6 weeks, and then we'll have you in for at least 2 weeks, and we'll work on it together. It'll be great. 6 weeks turned into like 3 months, and then I got a call December 13th or whatever that year, and they're like, we want you to come in and see the cut.
Oh.
I'm like,
But I don't remember doing that.
Exactly. I don't remember being in there for 2 weeks, but okay. You know, no. We just wanted to show you, and then we'll work on it, right? So it was actually like right around here. They had a screening room, and I went in. And now my cut was 97 minutes, right? And we really cut it down to the bone, like as tight as you could possibly make a movie like that. I went in, sat down, and then all of a sudden all these investors showed up, you know, like people that I knew because I'd seen them in like testimonial videos going like, I'm going to be in Hollywood. I'm just here. Here's $1 million. And they're all sitting down, and we watched the movie. 97 minutes turned into 71 minutes.
Oh.
Yeah. And it was a complete recut. Like, there was a big explanation in the beginning, like this big voiceover explanation, like, in a time, in a world, there was a book, the Sigil of Mammoth, and blah, blah, blah. It felt like the opening of, like, Army of Darkness. Yeah. You know? Which Army of Darkness is such an influential movie to that, or at least it was. But it felt like whoever was recutting it went like, okay, what are all the movies that we probably got influenced for this? Okay, let's watch all of those and do exactly what those did. They cut out a 10-minute ending because the owner of the company said he didn't like the lead character's dress. No, seriously. Didn't like, when we showed the movie, he kept talking about this fucking dress. Yeah, I don't know why, like that. I don't agree with that choice. I'm like, look, it's a dress. Like, it doesn't, like, in the grand scheme of things, if there is a palatable arc and the characters all feel like, you know, everything's resolved, everybody walks away. Believe me, there's half the movies I watch, I don't like what they're wearing. It doesn't matter. It's as long as the story is told. So, but then all of a sudden, that 10-minute ending turned into an Animal House end crawl where it's like, Joe and Beth ended up together. Gunther's still in game. Hung is waiting in the wings in the mountains of madness. It was.
So they just edit. They wrote stuff for the.
Oh yeah, like there was a PA system that kind of courses throughout the film where it's like, you know,
hear ye, hear ye. The, you know, the wise person wearing the foam armor should be going and closing the door of their car. Their lights are on. The Buick in this field has their lights on. Really dumb shit. They found a great opportunity to keep adding more stuff. So half the movie now has this weird narrator on the PA that is like explaining the movie to everyone.
So at that point, do you say like, so are we going to go talk about this? Or
when the movie was over, I turn around and go, well, that's a start. that's a direction. Like, no, we're really happy with this cut. Like, we want to go out with this. Like, and the first thing that came out of my mouth was, you can't release a 71-minute movie. You just can't. That's a short. That's a featurette. If I saw this, looked on the DVD box or, you know, looked at the listing and said 71 minutes long, yeah, I'm not watching that movie, you know? And I just said, okay, that's fine, you know, but let me get back in there and let's work on it together. You know, it's because when you're in the edit process, especially when it's not your money, it's a compromise. You know, you kind of have to make people happy or complacent, but you have to make yourself happy. My biggest fault when I look back at that movie was I was trying to make everybody else happy but myself because I wanted to make a day, you know, or I thought like, oh, I should just pick my battles because I really want this little thing, but I won't fight about that thing, you know, that edit that they like or that scene that they cut or put back in. And I was like, all right, look, I'm willing to work with you guys. It's totally cool. They're like, okay, no problem. Didn't hear from them for another month and a half. And then I called them up like, I do recall you saying, and I have this email that says that I was going to be in there for 2 weeks. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Okay, so I don't get any time? Well, maybe we'll make room for you on Tuesday. So you're giving me one day to sit down with this movie that, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it right now, is a fucking mess to try to fix the movie. Yeah, sure. So I drive up to the Valley, I go in, and the producer was not there, the actual editor was not there, it was the assistant editor. I didn't know this at the time. I'm like, hey, buddy, how's it going? So how many features have you worked on? He's like, none. I'm like, oh, this is going to go swell.
Yeah.
I'm like, so are you – he's like, oh, I'm the assistant. I'm just here to, you know, to help facilitate what you want. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess. So we start going through the notes, and I realize quickly, like by lunch, I'm like, this is not going to happen. Like nothing – this is not working out. So I just asked the guy. I'm like, are you even going to save the project when I leave here? He goes, no.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's, like as a dick move or as like being honest with you?
No, he was just being honest. He was totally, he felt bad for me. He was like, yeah. I'm really sorry, man. Cause like,
so what they put out was basically,
so essentially what they ended up getting the movie to, I think like 87 minutes, you know? But it was still, it's heartbreaking.
And is your name still on the movie?
Now that's where it gets tricky. Yes. My name is on there because at the time, cause I'm with the DGA. So the DGA states that you can't kick a director off, but the Alan Smithy, you know, rule is gone now. You're not allowed to do Alan Smithy as easily as it was, you know, back in the day where I'm like, I just directed Birds 2 and it sucks.
That's the first time I saw Alan.
That was the first time I saw it too, right? Yeah.
Land's End.
Jesus Christ.
Birds 2, Land's End.
Yeah. It was a Showtime movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, like for anybody who doesn't know, Alan Smithy is the name that you put on a movie.
The fake name.
Yeah, it's a fake name. It's a pseudonym. But that became like in the late 90s that everybody knew what Alan Smithy was, so they kind of retired it. Now, if you want to take your name off of a movie, what you have to do is you have to put an appeal out. The appeals board looks at it. It's a three-stage process, but the final stage of it, which is – I don't understand why they even do this, but the third stage is that you have to go before like a jury of your peers mostly – but it has to be a unanimous vote saying that you can take your name off it. Now, if you take your name off of it, you're losing residuals. Like, you lose everything. Like, so I got paid okay on the movie, but I was really hoping that residuals would keep me through the dark times. You know, like when I did Wrong Turn 2, I got paid scale, but I still get checks today for that movie. You know, so I was thinking like, okay, I should fight for this because I still care about the movie. There's still elements of me in it. I just, you know, I'm not going to put myself out there as passionately to tell people to go see it like I wanted to, but if it's out there and it sells, in the end it's okay. But the third part of that appeal is that you have to go before this board and it has to be a unanimous vote, but there has to be a representative from the production company there as well, and they have to vote yes. If they vote no, it's over. So everybody in that whole directing team, like that whole the whole star chamber that all says like, yay, yay, yay. You'll have that one asshole from the production company who's like, nay, and that's it. It's over. You know, so I just said, fuck it. Keep my name on it, but there's nothing I can do.
It's crazy to have your name on something that you didn't really make. I think you'd have to do something pretty terrible to like ruin your career. But I'm sure in your mind, you're like, well, I guess this wasn't fun, didn't go well, and is gonna hurt me now.
Well, because everybody, you know, it's that old feeling that, you know, you're only as good as your last movie. You know, so everything counts. You know, you have to make sure that whatever you're making, it, you know, it's a critical success and it makes a lot of money, because that's going to propel you to the next project.
Right.
So, it was just a constant back and forth. And then these investors started getting in touch with me and they're like, dude, those people that made that movie, total shenanigans. Like they're a bunch of crooks and they didn't tell you what they were supposed to, like they didn't tell you the whole story, and they, you know, kind of laid it all out. And I go, look, I'm contractually bound at the time to, I can't really go out there and be like, no, this is an outrage. Join me, nerds. You know, it wasn't going to happen. So I tried to keep a little quiet, and then I found out that they were doing a fire sale with the movie because no one was going to buy it. Like, there was such a stink on the movie at this point, because it was like a year and a half and I wasn't talking about it anymore. And everyone was like, what's going on with this movie? It was in Comic-Con like a year ago. Why isn't it out now? So people started asking questions. So then there was this kind of fire sale where they have all these distributors come in and, you know, watch your movie. And I found this out, and a lot of the investors were like, dude, I can't wait to see your movie. Oh my God, look, I'm going just for you. And I'm like, no, like, this is bad news. It was like offending me that they were using, you know, both my fans to get the word out. And it hurt me. So what I did was, without going into like pure slander, I took a picture of a paper cut. It was a thumb with a paper cut that I found on the internet. Put it on Instagram and hashtag not my cut. Within an hour, it was a news piece. Like, it was on Slash Film. It was on Badass Digest. It was on Ain't It Cool. Like, people saying like, what the fuck is this with this not my cut thing? You know? And it really, it like became a news piece, so that by Tuesday when they screened the movie, a bunch of people were in the theater and they went, give Joe's cut back. It was like, holy shit. My God. Like, I didn't expect that at all. But it did get sold. It got sold to E1, and, you know, and they were going to put it out with me or without me, you know, and that, whatever, that's fine. But I knew that there was nothing that was going to take, nothing was going to get me to endorse the movie at that time. I was like, no, I'm an auteur. I'm not going to go out there and shill a lesser version of what I wanted. Because look, when you know what it's like, when you go out there and you're addressing 7,000 people and you tell them you genuinely love this movie, you know, and I've done this now twice. It's probably burned me both times, if anything, where I go, look, at that time when we did Comic-Con, I was still in, you know, I still had the idea that, well, we just ran out of money, but the cut's fine. I didn't know that they were going to recut at all. So I was like, we're going to do it. We got this. Someday you're going to see this, and I guarantee you're going to love it, you know, or at least you'll like it, or at least you'll like Dinklage. But now here's this thing that I just despise. Like, I've only watched it twice. And the first time that I watched it was that day, and the second time, my agents were like, we got to see this thing. I'm like, okay. We went there, and when it was over, they turned around and went, and when your agents do that, you're just like, oh, fuck me, you know, because now I have to make them work. Seriously, that's what it is. It's like, if you're, you know, the director of Whiplash and you make Whiplash, you're kind of doing the job for your reps, because all I have to do is be like, I got the Whiplash guy.
Right.
And that's it. As opposed to, yeah, you know that movie Knights of Badassdom? Yeah, yeah. And then they got to go into a whole spiel and then be like, no, but it wasn't like that.
The guy
really knows what he's doing. So, you know, the word got out that we had this kind of stinky movie or whatever, and I just tried to distance myself from it. So, weirdly enough, the movie comes out. It came out last year on VOD and then went on Blu-ray. And again, I just tried to just not shit on the movie, because who am I? Like, once the movie goes out there, it's not mine anymore. I just tried to just keep a safe distance and not sit there like I am now with Everly. We're going like, see this movie, hashtag, retweet, just get it all out there. I just didn't do it. We started a podcast. Adam Green and I started this podcast 2 years ago called The Movie Crypt, which kind of was an offshoot of Halston. Didn't expect this. We were going to just do it for 10 weeks just to promote the show, and that was it. Suddenly, the people, we did it at Geek Nation, and suddenly they go, well, you have 125,000 listeners now every week. you should probably keep going. And we're like, fuck it, why not? So every Friday, we've been doing it for 2 years now. We just had Nicotero on last week. He says hi, by the way.
Excellent.
But, you know, now, like, James Gunn was just on, Henry Rollins was just on. Like, but the idea behind the podcast is that it's for creative people to just come in and just kind of talk shop. That's it. You know, if you want to vent, great. If you don't, if you want to geek out, totally fine. We used you guys as a model.
Of course.
So
one time we'll be models, guys.
Yay! Jesus. So we had Don Coscarelli on, the great Don Coscarelli. Did Phantasm, Bubba Hotep. He had just done John Dies at the End, and I mean, I've been a fan of his because of Beastmaster. It wasn't Phantasm. It was motherfucking Beastmaster. So that was my gateway drug to Don Coscarelli. Because after that, Mark Singer and Rip Torn and Ferrets. Like, it had that movie's got everything. Ferrets, Rip Torn, you know. It was such a seminal movie for me because I had seen it at the drive-in. It was one of those few drive-in movies where it was so either good, bad, or bad, good that your parents actually said, let's stay for the next one. Like, so we watched that. I think it was Black Hole, and then watch Beastmaster again. Like, that's how fucking great that night was. So, you know, and then it's on HBO every other day because the only two movies that they played on HBO at the time was Brainstorm and Beastmaster, and Wimbledon. So Don's on, and at some point Beastmaster came up, and both of us turned into 10-year-old kids like, oh, my God, Beastmaster is my favorite movie. And we watched his face kind of sour, like his face twisted and everything. He's just like, like he didn't want to talk about it. And of course, I'm like, Don, what's going on? He goes, I hate that fucking movie. I'm like, why? He goes, because they took the cut away from
it. Oh.
And immediately.
I put a post in Variety of a picture of a paper cut.
Yeah, exactly.
I put it on the
reporter.
It cost me $7,000.
Instagram is a lot cheaper these days. But it quickly changed my perspective on the movie immediately. Like right from there, I go, I can't shit talk that movie because there's a lot, and this is true, there's a lot of people who like that movie, you know, that don't know about the controversy, don't know about me or any of the drama that happened. They just watched it on Redbox or Netflix or
Xanax, you
know, or Xanax or BitTorrent, and their pinkies got numb, and they just saw it at face value and they enjoyed it, you know, for what it is. Now, is it the thing that I wanted it to be? No, but at the end of the day, who cares?
Well, as we're sort of winding this down, how did just give a little bit of about Everly?
You might as well.
You're here.
Yeah.
I mean, you might as well.
This was supposed to happen 3 years ago in my bucket list time. You know, I was like, I'm going to make nights. I'm going to hang out with the Nerdist guys. It's all going to work out.
Technically, you did do those things.
It just took 3 more years to do it,
And we're also going to have to re-edit this podcast where you're mostly out of it.
But okay, good. That's probably
for
the
best.
You'll
have a couple minutes.
And then you can use the thumb again.
Not my cut.
Nerdist podcast,
not my cut. Perfect.
As an intro to Everly, Deanna and I and Emily and Kumail all went to Fantastic Fest, and we got to see Everly, which was awesome. It was the best movie to see, not knowing, because I didn't... Like, it's like, I know you sent me the trailer, but I was like, I knew I was going to be seeing it at Fantastic Fest, and so I didn't want to watch the trailer. Because it's also, that's the best part about Fantastic Fest, is just seeing everything cool.
The colder you can go into, and have you been to Fantastic Fest before?
That's the one Austin festival I've not been to. I've been to fucking every other festival.
It's the best.
I know you've been. Movies. That's all. It's like there's no.
And you're wearing the Alamo Drafthouse.
Yes, I am. I only wear Alamo Drafthouse shirts.
It's such a great festival just because it really is. It's like there's no like parties. It's like everyone's gonna be like, well, I'll probably just stick around, do something around town, then go to the party. Like, there's really no sanctioned.
They
parties.
Have the highball next door. That is the party.
There's like the bar connected to the place.
Then you actually have to go watch the thing that people made.
Exactly. Oh, I wish they would show the thing.
Crazy.
Yeah, it would be nice if they
showed. But yeah, so it's a fantastic festival, and then like getting to see your movie with a whole huge crowd and just people just like, you know, applause breaks for some of the stuff in this movie. It was so fun. It's like, it's a good party movie. I like Cheap Thrills or, you know, any kind of one of those movies where it's like, get it like a group of friends together to see it because it's just like, it's like a, just this like fucking awesome party movie. It's a feel good movie.
It is not a feel good movie. It's the feel bad hit of January / February. Post-Oscar season.
Come on.
Well,
thank you. It was fun.
But yeah, the movie is called Everly. It stars Salma Hayek, and it is I've been using, I don't know why, like at, when we were at Comic-Con, because I went back to Comic-Con and they put us Hall H Saturday afternoon, but I'm sure that was because it was Salma Hayek was going to be there, which was, it was her first Comic-Con. When we were backstage, she's like, baby, go out and see how many people are there, you know, and I can't remember who was right before us, but I went out there and there's 7,000 people just waiting there patiently for us to start. And I go back there, I'm like, yeah, it's about a, I was trying to be nice, like 6,500 people. Ay, Dios mío! Like she didn't expect the craziness that was Comic-Con. She just probably thought it was like a junket and realized that it is the craziest junket of all time.
Right.
You know? But stars Salma Hayek as a woman who is trapped in an apartment. Her Yakuza, you know, boss slash slave keeper slash lover in a way, this guy named Taiko, he finds out that she's an informant and decides to send everybody to go get her. Like, I keep thinking of that moment in The Professional where Gary Oldman says, like, everyone! That's essentially what he's doing. So the movie takes place over the course of one night, and it all takes place in this one room, and we kind of went like Dogma 95 a little bit by actually having a rule saying, if she's in the room, or even if at points when she's not, the camera can never leave the rooms to give you that sense of claustrophobia. And also, spoiler alert, she makes it out. But to give you that catharsis when, the climax happens, just so that the audience can take that breath of fresh air. But it also allowed us to be those parameters helped us be more creative with the visuals, you know, instead of just being like, okay, master, you know, shot, get all the angles to get this fight scene. We would let scenes play out in oneers, you know, not quite Birdman oneers, but dynamic enough oneers that you don't normally see in an action movie.
Did the movie come out?
Movie is out on VOD now. It was just at the drive-in. Tonight is actually the last night that it's playing at the drive-in. So Radius, who put out Snowpiercer and Horns and Citizen 4 and everything, they bought the movie, but they were like, look, we're going to put it out on VOD first, and then we'll do theaters. I'm like, okay, well, that's the new way. You know, as long as we do theaters, that would be great, because I shot the movie super wide, you know, to be on a big screen and everything.
Did you get a print of it? You got it. Print on film?
No, but I'm working on that. I'm working on that. I'm not
going to show it at the new Bev. It's got to be on 35 mil.
Let's just say this. I'm working on that.
All right. Really?
Wink, wink, wink. Because the thing is, though, it's like, you know, Adam, my partner, has like these film cans. Like, oh, man, just hauling out this, you know, copy of Hatchet 2 in these big fucking crates. And I'm like, oh, here's my DCP for Everly. All this hard work. Here it is. Boom. There it is. All
that. Here's my hard work. Is
ta-da!
This a thumb drive?
But yeah. You got to make the movie you wanted. You got to, you came back from what was kind of a bummer experience.
The worst. Those are moments that I've talked to other filmmakers and they're like, dude, I would have quit.
Yeah, I would have been a badass. Pretty much syphilis on your face.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I got a
and
big
Everly
fat
was the color correction.
well put,
thank
sir.
Thank you. You know, my
good setup too, so he went up.
There's a
might want to give it back where
just
it
was, yeah, just saying.
It's the, kind of a thwap.
Sometimes
to
an alley-oop has it needs an alley and then the oop.
You're just trying to get your triple double up, huh, Jonas?
My there's sort of this thing that the guy that makes us lift heavy things in a gime.
Tom
he says
J.
Tom J. Dieters, who has a new podcast that's really good. But he there are moments where you kind of go until you can't do something anymore. Mm-hmm. It's like you go to failure. It's like, oh, you get to failure. Doesn't matter how many do you get to failure. And then everything you do after that, he was like, this is where the growth happens. Mm-hmm. It's not coming in and feeling amazing and everything's perfect and the weather's perfect and, it, you know, like, you just, you knock everything off the charts. He was like, the moments of growth happen when you're basically on your ass.
Yeah, it's true.
And so,
though,
had your first film gone brilliantly, you may not have learned as much. You may not have appreciated as much. I'm sure you would have preferred that Badassdom had been, you know, everything you wanted to be.
Well, my first film actually was a success. Wrong Turn 2, Dead End. But it was this. But I was like, can't let the sophomore slump happen. Like, because that you learn that in film school. Like, people talk about that. Like, oh, remember the Hughes brothers? You know, Menace to Society. Dead presidents. You know, like, it was, there were so many people who talked about the sophomore slump. So that's another reason why I was like psyching myself out going, no sophomore slump, no sophomore slump.
So just really quickly in one bite-sized chunk, what did you learn and what did you take away and how did you make it work this time?
For better or for worse, I learned to trust myself, you know, because
in nights I was trying so hard to please everybody else, and you never watch a movie and say, wow, they really made their day. Never. You never sit there and go like, my God, they really maximize those 12 hours like a boss.
And that was in Spokane, and you can't shoot between certain hours.
No. So,
hey, come take a look at this movie. They shot in Spokane. It's mostly dark.
It was mostly finished.
I just saw this amazing movie. It came in under budget. It was incredible.
But that's the thing. No one does
6.75, but he only had 1.7.
Do you know what does kill me, though, about movies sometimes is the overuse of shooting day for night.
Oh,
when there are hard
shit.
Shadows, I hate it. Or don't watch The Mummy. Don't watch The Mummy.
The reboot one?
The original The Mummy. Well, I mean the 1996 Mummy.
Can you believe that you just said the original Mummy with the Brendan Fraser version?
I can't believe that I did that. Christ.
There was one before that?
It was black and white, but I'm sure no one watched
Steven
that
Summers.
One.
He sure likes daylight.
Well, but anyway, so the thing that I learned from that was to just trust myself and just to take a moment, like on Everly, every day there was so many complications. There was so much, you know, on a production, it's a stressful situation. So it would be me just saying, what do I want? You know, what do I want in this moment? You know, and following my heart, you know. And again, there are people who hate this movie. But when I read those bad reviews, because and I like reading the bad reviews, I like reading all the reviews because I'm having a dialogue with a person. I made this movie and put it out there. They watched it and they're giving it back. Whether it's good or bad, it's an opinion, whatever. I'll just hang out with the people who like the movie. but it was those things that, like, there's some hard shit in this movie, and it's a tonal roller coaster. You're cringing at one moment and laughing at the next, but that's life. So I just kind of went with it, you know, and I just went with it in a way that made me happy. And I can watch this movie, like they showed it last night, and I can sit there and I can watch it. And that to me is a testament. It's not an ego thing. It just means that I can't really watch any of my own stuff, but I can sit there and go, I did right by the story, by the character, and whether you like it or not, you know, maybe then just means we won't hang out.
So what is your Twitter handle that people can say hi to you?
At the Joe Lynch, nice and easy.
At
the Joe Lynch.
At the Joe Lynch.
There's a lot of Joe Lynches out there. But
you're not the only one.
The Irish bastard.
Would you like to do the ceremonial sign-off?
Oh, man. Really?
Yeah.
I really wish I had a fucking burrito right now. God damn it. Yes, I can. And everybody, enjoy your burrito.
That was nice, Joe Lynch.
That was a nice one.
Yeah, but there's always, you know, like you always have this like velvety exit when you like, enjoy your burrito, everybody.
Oh, yeah.
It's
because he's falling asleep at the microphone. Enjoy.
Oh, is that what it is? But
yeah. Chris does do this thing sometimes where, I mean, it's not when he's tired, but it's when he's like just listening where he just starts going... bumping his nose.
Do you know why? Because these little fluffy windscreens are so they're like Muppet noses.
That's what we have to tell the people when they come into the when we tell people come into the podcast. Nose. We're like, you have to blow the Muppet, and immediately, like, you'd sit there and be like, Jordan. It was, we had Jordan Peele on a couple months ago, and we're like, just blow the Muppet. He's like, you got a baby. I got that covered.
I just like the way it feels. It's so soft and
kind of like.
All right, start the hammer.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now, in hardcover or digital editions, wherever you get your books.